everyone, and welcome to episode 127 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we career our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and join me once again today to tell us so many interesting things about what's going on in Band of Brothers is Jim O'Kane of the Captain America Minute. Welcome back once again.
The war is over, but the podcast lives on. So we're gonna go after post-war Band of Brothers now. That's great.
Well, why not? Yeah, that's the way these things work.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, you gotta keep talking about it. We'll keep going.
Yes, that's true. So episode 127 begins with a panning shot of occupied Austria and ends with the company on parade. So we left things off yesterday with the men entering Austria, being mesmerized by everything around them. And this segment continues that. You know, it gives us a panning shot of the Jeep coming up a mountain. And we see all of these peasants or Austrian women on the side just, you know, waving to them and shouting to them. And the soldiers just start, responding to them. Hey, how are you? One of them goes, do you need a hand there? He goes, hey, yo, hi. And another one, he loves you. Now, I find this a little strange because, and maybe you can set me straight on this one. My understanding always was that just like the Germans, the Austrians were very happy to work with Hitler. And the fact that, I mean, I can understand when they're getting to, you know, when they were in Eindhoven and, you know, the men in the town decided, you know, that they were going to separate the women who collaborated and stuff like that. That's fine. But there were people who were generally genuinely happy to be liberated. They're making it seem as if the people, the women in this area, again, this is very, this is deep Nazi love area. I don't know.
This is old school Nazis. I mean, this is where it all started. This is Anschluss
that's
land.
Right.
And
so why are all of these women, being showing that they're happy they're being that their area is being occupied, unless they all have nefarious ideas of what they're going to do to either save their own lives or, you know, take some of these Americans with them.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No, it's I welcome our insect overlords. I don't know what it's kind of you better make put on a good face for the conquerors. Or could they be, I mean, and I don't know how old these girls are, but they may have not known any life besides, you know, when they were little kids being in a this is not a Nazi occupied territory in Anschluss. This is just Nazi land.
That's my point. It's not we've conquered you and now you have to listen to our ideas. It's that we are the conquerors,
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's the Von Trapp family that stayed behind, but it's possible they were like the Von Trapps that didn't get away, but I don't know. It's and we are 6 or 7 years in for these women, or even if they're teenagers, this is all they've known. Unless their parents were virulent anti-Nazis, they couldn't talk about it, and now they're happy to. But I don't understand that part. I'm just going with the thought that they're putting on a happy face because this is, the new boss is in town.
Right. And, one of the things that they talk about in the book. So there's a very interesting paragraph on page 227. Which I'll read. This is the contrast in appearance was almost as great as the contrast in numbers. The conquering army looked sloppy, unmilitary, ill-disciplined. The conquered army looked sharp, with an impressive military appearance and obvious discipline. Winters felt that the German soldiers and Austrian civilians must have wondered as they gazed fascinated at the first American troops to arrive in the area, how on earth they could have lost to these guys.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds kind of like Lee and Grant at the at Appomattox Courthouse. When Lee showed up to surrender, he was in his best uniform, and Grant didn't have anything clean, so he borrowed the nearest thing that he could find was a dirty private's uniform that he put on to wear to the surrender ceremony at Appomattox Courthouse. So it, you know, it must have felt weird for the Confederates who were all trying to put their best face on this, that, well, it's over now, and the winners don't have to dress
Yeah,
up.
it's again, but so it's very interesting the way that it's described here, from that perspective.
Yeah, and the place that they were meeting at, that hotel, again, this is, you know, Austria. It's amazing how Easy Company found themselves in the most untouched parts of the Third
But again,
Reich.
it's deep in enemy territory
Yeah.
that nobody they didn't even need they didn't get there.
Yeah. It was far away from the fighting. This is the interior, and you know, you wind up with these beautiful, bucolic would be the term, lakefront property, and all the guys that were there, the German army that was there, had to have been, I want to say, the favored group, because they weren't on the Eastern Front, they weren't on the Western Front, and they got pulling this duty of, oh, by the way, we're going to stick you up in a lake in Austria. Sure, I'm there. So these guys had the cushiest jobs in the entire German military. It's interesting to think about how, you know, there was people like, you know, these are probably the guys that went out with Goering, the Nazi equivalent of the Monuments Men. They were out shopping for art treasures and stuff. So all these guys had really dirty hands, and although they didn't, you know, no dirt under the fingernails, they lived it up. They were the ones that stacked those 10,000 bottles.
That's true.
So it must have been, what are we going to do now? They're going, you know, it's hide all the rope and pray that we can take down all the lampposts in time.
Right.
They didn't know what was going to happen.
That's true. And I mean, as the truck drives by these women, so Malarkey goes, "The war is over." these guys are definitely on a high, watching everything going on here.
Oh yeah.
And it continues with more shots of everything going on, and the trucks all are parked along the side, and the jeeps keep moving forward, and they come to this huge, beautiful hotel. Again, they're going to be living. They're li going to be living it up in style. That's the type of thing.
Yep.
And Nixon then goes, "We'll be comfortable here." So it's nice the way that they do that, and we see that Nixon and Winters easily climb up these stairs to go into the hotel, and you see in the background again a gorgeous lake. I mean, we obviously started at the beginning of this of this part. This is where Winters and Nixon were having their conversation, and where Winters went for a swim.
Yeah.
This is basically where they are in, until till the end, basically.
Yes.
And so it's just great watching the way that these occupying forces have decided to deal with it. And then the shot changes, and we're inside, I guess, of this hotel. And Nixon, Winters is sitting at a small little table, and there's a German officer next to him, and goes, "I wonder what will happen to us, to people like you and me, when there are finally no more wars to occupy us." Now, that line is definitely a line being said by someone who has just lost the war. I don't think Winters is in the same mindset.
Yeah, this is, he's got immediate things, and I don't think I don't think he's thinking that far ahead. He's like, this is just what we're thinking how to do. And this guy's, this extremely Teutonic looking colonel, it looks like he's just been sitting there waiting for the Allies to come up over the hill because he knew this day was coming. He probably heard about this about a month ago. He's like, well, if they get here before the Russians will be kind of okay.
Exactly.
So I think he's almost relieved, I think, is the way I'm getting the feeling from him. Like, oh, and then he's gonna chum it up with
Well, I
Winters.
think he's relieved in some ways,
And
but he also he's trying to make it seem that as soldiers we have to find something else to do in life. That type of thing. So, and again, once you've advanced to colonel, it means that you've been in the army a long enough time. You didn't just join up yesterday.
yeah.
You're there because you want to be there, because you enjoy this lifestyle and you enjoy whatever it is that you're doing.
Yeah, and he definitely has a cushy duty here. I mean, this is going to be over for him, and he's going to be, bagging potatoes in a couple of months. But
Probably.
yeah.
Before they send him to America to work on the space
Yeah,
program.
yeah. Hopefully he has any engineering skill. He'll be on
That's right.
the next bus to New Mexico.
That's right. And then Winters just responds and goes, "Have all your men collect the weapons, deposit them at the church, at the school, and at the airfield." Now, I gotta say, those are pretty interesting places for them to leave your guns. Leave your guns in the church. Leave your guns in the school. And leave your guns at the airfield.
Yeah.
Those are probably the three last places that I would want to people to be stockpiling weapons.
Yeah,
You have a place with sanctuary, a place with miners, and a place where there's a lot of planes. I don't know.
Wow, yeah, and it's and he just says leave your weapons. So I mean, do they have any tanks, APCs, bazookas? I'm not sure
Exactly.
where, how what kind of equipment does he have? And it's like, well, do you want us to pull this out of the army and drop it up, armory and put this up at the school or what?
It's a little interesting. And then the German just says, "We will." And then you see that he takes out his gun and also takes out the cartridge as he's checking his weapon, and he wants to hand over his pistol to Winters, and he goes, "Please accept this as my formal surrender, Major. It is better than to lay it on the desk of a clerk." So what he's basically saying is, "I'm not going to your church, school, or airfield to give in my gun. I'm going to give it to you." And Winters interestingly says to him, "Well, you can keep your sidearm, Colonel." It's a very nice gesture, but
Yeah.
I don't know if it's the safest gesture to
It's
be making, because
well,
you don't
it
know who this Colonel is. If he is in some ways a Hitler fanatic,
yeah, one of the werewolves or something. You got the that was a group that was actually designed after the war to take vengeance. But
exactly.
this is actually a as a matter of protocol and surrender, it's typically that's the format that's done, and that's been, I mean, hundreds of years. At the end of the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, when well Cornwallis was supposed to surrender to Washington at Yorktown, Virginia, but Cornwallis said that he was sick, so he sent his second in command, Brigadier General Charles O'Hara, to lead the British troops and formally surrender. And so what happened was, O'Hara tried to present the sword to the French general who was there, Rochambeau, and he said, no, you got to give your sword to Washington. Actually, O'Hara had Cornwallis's sword with him, but Cornwallis didn't show up. So O'Hara turned to General Washington, and Washington said, no, I'm not taking it personally because Cornwallis was the guy in charge, and since Washington was the guy in charge, he wouldn't take it. So Washington told O'Hara, the British guy, to surrender the sword to his own second in command, who was Major General Benjamin Lincoln. And then Lincoln took the sword from O'Hara, and then after accepting it, Lincoln immediately returned the sword back to O'Hara because that's the common courtesy in all of these surrender things. And same thing with the Civil War. Lee offered his sword to Grant, and then Grant turned the sword back to Lee. The major difference in the Civil War versus World War II, Lee had requested that his troops could keep their rifles because the Confederates were starving and they needed to use their guns for hunting, and a lot of them had brought their own weapons. So Grant told them that the Confederates could keep their own weapons. So a little bit different than World War II. Although
Right, but also a little different than the way we look at it nowadays. Nowadays, I would not, want to leave my enemy with a weapon. Maybe
I
it's
think that.
more the idea of that they were that officers acted more like gentlemen back then, I guess.
Yeah, you want to completely disassemble the ability to fight. I was looking up what happened with, all these, you figure all these Germans turning in their weapons, what happened to them? And what happened, the Allies divided the captured German weapons as booty. The Soviet Union got the largest share, especially from the Eastern Front. And the Soviets redeployed the weapons that they got from the German surrenders to their own forces and then shipped others to satellites like North Korea and China. And they were later used in the Korean War. North Korea used a lot of World War II German equipment that the Soviets had given them. And the rest of it was scrapped. The United States got amounts of small arms and some vehicles. They tested them. They kept samples for intelligence or museum, but they scrapped most of them. There was very little long-term use. The British scrapped most of it. They discouraged other countries from using German weapons. They discouraged most other countries from using the German weapons that they had to promote British arms sales. And in France got all the panzers. They were they the French had a couple of panzers in their army until the early 1950s. They were using German panzers as a in their colonies.
Oh wow. Interesting. Again, we'll talk about it later in this part. The fact that a lot of the American troops also had German weapons to take home as souvenirs. So I guess they weren't keeping track as well at that time.
Yeah, the customs department didn't really focus too much. So.
Right, they didn't have an Excel sheet writing it all down,
Yeah.
and oh, this
No.
guy gave in his this Luger, and that one gave in that gun,
Yeah.
and things like that.
There was a yeah, no TSA at the airfield, I guess.
No. And then we have a very interesting scene here, where it shows us the men watching a newsreel about what's going on in the Pacific at that time. And we hear the announcer say, "Heroic dead of our combined Army and Marine Corps mark the grim battlefield of Okinawa, where one of the bloodiest invasions of the war is being fought. Thousands of Yanks have been wounded." Do you know when the Battle of Okinawa was being fought?
As a matter of fact, it started on April the 1st, known as L Day or Love Day. We had D Day for France, but they called L for landing, or the code was Love Day. It was fought April 1st through the 22nd of June,
Very good. Very good.
dropping 60,000 troops on the beach. It was the largest. I mean, the invasion force was larger than D Day, at least where the Americans were concerned. And just imagine being able to drop 60,000 troops on the other side of the planet from the United States, and coordinating that with an enemy that was going to fight to the last man. A lot harder fighting there than on D-Day. Although it doesn't get as much air time. I mean, we have movies like The Longest Day and Saving Private Ryan and things like that. But the Battle of Okinawa is one of the hardest fought campaigns of
Well,
World War II, and here
you do
it
have Hacksaw
happened.
Ridge that's all about the Battle of Okinawa,
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
and it
yeah.
shows you how brutal it is,
But
or it
it,
was.
yeah, yeah. It's just incredible that the fighting was so strong there at the very end, and an impossible. It's the bravery of getting in there, and the fighting, on. it was all close quarter stuff because it's hilly, a hilly environment. There was mud, there were swamps, there was all kinds of things that would slow you down or trap you. So yeah, Battle of Mindanao is a pretty nasty, nasty fight. And that's, and picture all these guys that just finished a year's worth of marching across Europe, getting to Austria, getting to this beautiful environment, this lakeside hilltop, and all of a sudden they say, "Oh, by the way, we might be sending you
That's
into
right.
all of this," and then all you're hearing is machine guns and stuff off the, and they know that the narration is a bit optimistic,
Very
as it
much.
were.
I mean, again, it's a war propaganda film,
Yeah.
and they're showing it to these soldiers who potentially are going to be shipped across the world for that type of thing. And then we see that
Yeah.
Nixon shows up, and he looks a little disheveled and drunk with what he's doing. And then the newsreel continues, and we hear, "To drive a fanatical foe from this final base along the Jap southern defense line, the Yanks progress slowly, facing one of the fiercest artillery barrages of the war. Each small advance is gained by sheer grit in the face of withering fire from a suicidal enemy being slowly hammered back into the hills. The going is brutal, and our casualties are high, but Okinawa is the next big step towards victory over Japan. A victory that can only be won by work, war bonds, and heroic sacrifice." Again, this is definitely the language is very propaganda.
Yeah,
By war.
no, and these fellas all understand that completely. It's like, yeah, it's not that. It's, whatever they're showing on the screen, it ain't what the guy's talking
That's
about.
right. But they do a great job then of focusing on the faces of Nixon and Winters, basically both of them looking somewhat in shock as to what's really going on in these pictures, at least from the Pacific. Because again, they have no clue what's really going on there. But
Yeah.
it's interesting that they do this to show also how all of the other men are reacting to what they're watching on the screen. Because again, this is what they had in
Yeah, and
1945. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have TikTok, where you can quickly see what's going on and stuff like that. This is
yeah, no, it's been a month to ship this thing. First they had to ship the movie back from the Pacific, and then they had to edit it, and then they had to send it over to Europe. So, and it's not flying by plane, or maybe the last batch is flying by plane, but it's probably been sitting on a boat for a couple of weeks before making
Right,
harbor in London
unless they
somewhere.
decided to make it an easier process and just basically shoot everything in California on a sound stage
Yeah.
and shipping that over too.
Yeah. That guy looks an awful lot like Clark
That's
Gable. Why is that? Yeah. So yeah, in any case, they kind of sugarcoat it, but it's definitely the soldiers. You can tell from the looks on the soldiers, they're all pondering. I'm never gonna get home. I'm gonna stop off in California, and then they're gonna put me on a boat, and then I'm gonna wind up over there fighting a million
Do you think that's the
enraged
way that they would
Japanese.
have? Do you think that's the way
Fighting
they
for their
shipped
homeland.
people from Europe to the Pacific? They would.
I think they would have shipped them. I mean, they would have shipped them home like they normally would from from. They'd probably get them to either Le Havre or Portsmouth, and then ship them to New York, process them in Springfield, Massachusetts. I forget the name of the base. But then they'd sort them out and say, okay, you guys that are staying in, we're gonna send you west, and they'll put them on a train, send them to San Diego, put them on a Navy carrier, and then get them over to the other side. I think that would be the route. They'd go across by train, then on the Pacific side, they'd stick them on
Interesting.
troop carriers.
But again, having to get them across the US is also a problem because, at that point they could scatter.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if I don't know how many would go AWOL, but it's at the peak, that would be like 1945, 1946. That was the peak of American railroading. So the fastest way across the U.S., you could make it in, let's see, 20 hours, 26 hours. You could go from Springfield, Massachusetts to San Diego probably in about a day and a half, a full day and a half to get across there. Change it to Chicago, change it. Yeah, that's, you just change it to Chicago and they'd run it straight to Los Angeles and then down to San Diego.
Interesting. Okay. Makes sense. Now, something I forgot to mention before, the when the German officer was surrendering to the Winters, Winters eventually kept that gun.
Really?
Yes. And it was a gun that had never been fired through the entire time in the war. And Winters held onto it till the day he died.
Wow.
And he never fired that gun. And he left instructions to be buried with the gun. So this was a gun that would never,
Never see,
ever,
yeah, be fired. Wow. Impressive.
which is very interesting the way that they show that. It makes me wonder if he gave it back. So how did he get it? By the way,
Yeah, right. Maybe they kept up correspondence.
When you're ready to leave, give me this gun.
Yeah. If you don't need it, I'm just saying. Yeah.
I might want to keep it for something.
Yeah, I mean, he was there for months, and I'm not assuming that the colonel is jumping on a train going back to wherever he was at, because he has it pretty good where he's at. And he might have had family that he had moved to Austria as part of his duty cycle. Like, this is where I'm gonna be, so bring the wife and kids over. So maybe he was living in that part of Austria, and you know, if Winters is out taking daily swims, maybe, hey, it's that that German guy that surrendered to me. How you doing today? And so, you know, maybe they, I wouldn't call it a friendship, but at least they had an acquaintance.
And at this point, the movie ends, and these guys get up, and they're starting to leave the room. And Spears comes over to Winters, who's standing next to Nixon, and obviously Lip is there also. And so, when are we going? Winters, we don't have a date yet. Well, would you tell them in right away? Then Winters goes, "Well, some of them will have enough points to go home instead." Nixon says, "Not many, if they're only medals of Purple Heart." So, they start talking about the idea of points. And I know that you specifically requested to be on the episodes that we discuss points. So, Jim, what do you have to say about points?
Well, I think they discuss this so much about what do you need to get out, and much like the B-17 pilots, if you've ever seen 12 O'Clock High, they talk about points, and it's how many missions you've flown. If you get 25 missions, then that's your last mission, you get to go home. But the points kept moving up because they needed you there. They said, no, you can't go home, the war's not over yet, we figured we'd let you go and get new people. So in this one, you would get 1 point for every month of military service from September 16th, 1940 onward.
Now, do you know what the official name of points was?
I do not know.
It was the adjusted service rating score.
Ah, okay. So you get scored for these things. So 1 point. So if you're in the battle for 5 years, that would be 60 points. So you'd need another 15.
No, you need another 25. No, you
So,
need 85, don't you?
wait, I'm sorry, 85. Excuse me. I'm not mathing
That's it.
right. So yeah, you need you yeah. So if you got you get one additional point for each month you serve overseas. So, and then you get 5 points for each campaign star or qualifying combat decoration or award. So if you got like a Distinguished Service Medal, or if your company was given a campaign star, you were there on D-Day, you get an extra 5 points. And then the big one, which if you had foresight, you could have solved this problem.
Not if you're
You
17
get you get
or younger.
yeah, that's true. That might be a little difficult, but you get 12 points for every dependent child under 18, up to a maximum of 3 children. So you have potential 36 points waiting for you at home. And Now, in June of 1945, though this was announced immediately after Germany's surrender. Soldiers who reached 85 points were placed in Category 4 and given priority to ship home as transport became available. Now, that's the problem. When transport became available, how do you get millions of troops overseas home? You can't just put them on one big boat and ship them home. You got to wait for the ships to go out, ships to come back, ships to get reloaded. And it took a while to just get everybody in, these little ships going back and forth. So it made sense. And now, just because you were in Category 4 and you had your 85 points, you still weren't going home right away because they still had to figure out how far east you were. The further east you were, the less likely you were to go home immediately. So if you were somehow, if you were like, if you were in England, you'd go home early. If you were in France, you'd go home a little bit after that. Netherlands, after that. Eastern, Alsatia, after that. And then as you're getting into the occupied, like Germany, Austria, you're probably end of the line for people coming home, even if you had 85 points. So these guys, they're on the other side of Germany, they're way into Austria. So even if they have 85 points, you're not getting on a truck and going to the port tomorrow, unless you have special. Well, we'll get into that too later. But if you have, you're not going to get priority for being moved from the east to
Right.
out to the coast of France.
So here, I have a question for you. How come Al Stevenson wasn't sent home earlier? He would have gotten already, those 24 points for his kids and having spent how many years? I mean,
Yeah,
how are
well.
he and Fred Derry, getting home at the same time? And I mean, Homer himself was going through rehabilitation, so that you can sort of understand. I don't think he went home with points.
No, but Al was a sergeant, and he was NCO, and also officers had similar, but they were different requirements. And officers sometimes went home earlier because if you're on missions, like it's like
Just to explain to anybody who
Fred was
doesn't know
in.
what we're talking about.
And by the way, yeah,
We're talking
we're
about the
talking about a
freedom of
different
press
movie.
in the past year that we're in.
Rob shifted gears suddenly. We're in a different movie, so we're talking about the guys in the best years of our lives, the three soldiers, well, two soldiers and a sailor that are going home, Homer Parrish, Al Stevenson, and Fred Dury are all coming home on the same B-17, but they're coming from different directions. Al Stevenson's coming from well, we don't know where Al
No, we know he
Stevenson
was
was
in the Pacific.
sent. But we know he was in the Pacific, but we don't know exactly. He was all the way
Right.
into Japan, and by then, so it's not. It's obviously it's not June. So there, he's coming in from some nondescript place on the Pacific theater. He's coming home with all these war trophies. It's well after Hiroshima, so the
Right.
majority of people have already come home. September, it's like September, you're getting people from France and Germany, and they're all on the last couple of boats. So Al's coming from the Pacific, from what we understand.
And just so you know, after VJ Day, they lowered the requirements to 75.
Right, yeah. So he had the months. He was not quite career, but he'd been in it for the long haul, and he's coming home. Fred, meanwhile, was a navigator on a B-17, and probably should have been coming home, but I guess he must have ticked somebody off, or he didn't have all of his points to get home from England. But he was trying to make it back to Boone City, and wound up at an airfield somewhere in the middle of the country. And then Homer Parrish, our disabled veteran, was also in the Pacific, and he's just coming back from a hospital, where he was being taught how to use the hooks that had replaced his hands. So they're all coming in late in the war. Actually, it's after the war is over. It's because Al Stevenson saw the radioactive effects of civilian, or he didn't notice the radioactive effects of civilians at Hiroshima. So we have to assume that it's late fall of 1945 when they're coming back. So they're really not. They all have points and things, but due to different reasons, they weren't getting back home until then. Homer for medical reasons, I'm assuming that Sergeant Stevenson, Sergeant Al, was probably involved after the surrender in Tokyo Bay. He was probably involved in setting up the government, the military government of Japan, and probably had to do some cleanup work there. He was a banker, so he's probably setting up ways of using American script to replace yen. Well, so he probably had some bookkeeping work to do that he stayed behind. And Fred, I don't know what's Fred's story though. It's kind of weird that he's getting home this late in the year, unless he was the one that was supposed to. Maybe he's been helping ferry B-17s back to the U.S. because there's a lot of equipment left behind in England, and he might have just been in charge of doing transatlantic flights to get things back to the U.S. So he's rolling these B-17s back one at a time. So he might not have been let go because they needed a navigator. Or a he was a bomb dropper, but
Right,
he also
he
worked
was a bomber.
navigating. Yeah, but I'm sure he knew navigation, so he put in a hand there.
Okay. An interesting point also is that anyone who was in the WACS, the woman in the Women's Army Corps, they only needed to get 44 points to be able to go home.
Huh. Wow.
And towards the end of the war, they decided that any men who had three or more dependent children under 18, they tried to fast track them home as quickly as possible.
Yeah, before they got drunk and got into a car accident, so that made
Yeah,
sense.
or got shot by somebody looking for gas. Do you think the point system worked? Do you think it was a good thing or a bad thing?
I think everybody got home, and they had to come up with some logical reason. And it might have not have been, it was probably unfair, but it was no more unfair than any other method of doing it. I mean, you could do last, first in, first out, but there's so many people scattered across. From a logistics viewpoint, it's really hard to get people who are at the front of the line to get, who are on the front lines to get them home first. It's easier just to empty out the people that were near port cities, just get rid of
Exactly.
them.
Right. The consensus is that it was better than nothing because that was the way the system worked, but it was very frustrating for people because there were people in cushy jobs in the rear that had families that got sent home back before some of the soldiers who had seen very hard combat because they were further inland at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And they had and the other thing is that it was hard to sort all those out because as you talked in probably in an earlier show, there were replacements out there. So the replacement that saw a harder time, were they going to go home before the cushy guys that had been in longer? It's hard to make it fair. It's
Well,
just
it depends
trying to
on how
get a
many
little.
times they got shot,
Yeah.
that's and if you're an easy company, it just means how many times. Now someone who got shot in the ass and it went through at four holes, did they get more points that way? I mean, did Buck and Percante and all the guys in here who kept getting shot in the butt? It's very strange.
Wow. Well, they got home. At least most of them got home. We're going to talk about that too.
That's right. We will continue talking about that over the next week and a half. And Winters then responds by saying, "I think most of us here will have enough. And each of us will have to decide what to do. I don't know how long we're waiting here for orders, but I want those veterans who are staying and all new replacements ready to fight. That means rifle ranges. That means daily close quarter drills, close order drills. That means troop reviews. But above all, it means physical training. Get your NCOs on it." And Nixon then says under his breath, "They're gonna love you." That's right.
It ain't over till it's over.
But
So,
again, Winters is right here. There's no question
yeah.
about it. I mean, we know what eventually what continues to happen after this, and obviously you need your men to be as tr well trained as possible here.
Yeah.
And it also shows that Winters is doing what he can, keep as many people as possible safe so that they can get back home to their families.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's going to be, you don't want to. Guys that have been drinking Vat 69 for the past month are going to be slogging it up the hills of Yokohama, and I mean, they don't know when that other war is going to end. Nobody knows anything about atomic bombs or anything. They just see a hard-fought war, and this could go on until 1950, as far as I know.
That's right. Well, again, we'll talk about that. Where I think maybe tomorrow that we're basically they think it's going to be another 2, 3 years at least.
Yeah.
And then the shot changes, and we see six of the men walking through the forest without helmets but guns in front of them, and Perkunti then lean crouches down, and Liebgott goes, "What are you crouching down for, Perko? You think the deer's gonna shoot back?" "Leave me alone." And Bull just goes, "How about y'all just shut up? Let Shifty kill some dinner." "Oh, what's the matter, Bull? You tired of eating dried up spuds 3 times a day?" And Liebgott goes, "You know what? I've got an idea. Why don't we just shoot Bull here? Feed the company for a week." And I love the bickering between them. It's great. It adds so much to the whole thing that
Oh yeah.
about these and the fact that these guys are used to being in combat situations, and here what they're doing is they're hunting for a deer, and the deer as he said will not shoot back. But there's certain things that it's already muscle memory. That's how you're going to be how you're going to be acting. You're expecting to be shot back at, that type
Yeah.
of thing. And then Shifty stops them and gets ready to shoot at one of the deers, and then the deer gets away. And Liebgott goes, "Oh, God damn it, Shifty. You let him get away. Army ought to be glad to be rid of you." Shifty goes, "I wish, it seems they want me to stay around a while." "Are you serious?" And Malarkey goes, "How many points do you need?" He goes, 15. And Malarkey then goes, 15? Jesus Christ, I thought I had it bad. And then Shifty goes, "No purple hearts. Never was injured." So you see, from that perspective, if you didn't get injured, you were going to be stuck there a little longer.
Yeah, it's like, and there's no battles to run into to fix this.
That's right.
So.
It's not like the end of Platoon where Francis just stabs himself and, "Oh, I've been wounded. There we go. Let me go home."
Yeah. You don't want to call your friend, call or write a letter to your wife. Are we sure we don't have two more kids at home? Are you sure?
That's right.
Just check out in the backyard.
You've seen Stalag 17, right?
Yeah,
Okay,
yeah.
where the guy is constantly knitting like
Oh, yeah.
knees, and he goes, "I believe it. I really do believe it." And that actor is actually the writer of the story. So it's just very funny. For anyone who wants to know what we're talking about, in Stalag 17, there's a character who's been informed by mail that his wife found a
His wife is
baby.
expecting, yeah.
No, his wife found a baby on the
Oh,
doorstep,
yeah.
and the baby looks exactly like her. And he's "I believe it. I believe it." it's interesting the way that there's a connection there, between
Yeah.
that whole thing. And I mean, bottom line is that these guys, what they're trying to show here is they're sort of getting trigger happy that they just got to get out of this situation.
Yeah.
And then we get a few seconds of the men on parade, and Moore calls out, "Company and platoon, attend, hut!" And we see everyone stand at attention, and that is how this 5-minute segment ends. So
Wow. Yes, that ends in their class A's for a
that's right.
change. They're all
That's
dressed
right.
up.
So, Jim, is there anything else that you want to discuss about this particular segment that we might have missed?
I do. I keep thinking this is, well, I mean, it's kind of a little bit too on the nose, but it's very reminiscent of the Deer Hunter,
Yes.
of just when you've been through the experience, it's like you just don't want to kill another thing. So
And
it's just
we'll get more
it's
insight into
it.
that I think tomorrow when
Yeah,
Shipkeep talks
tomorrow,
about
yeah.
that, and it's funny because Shifty again, we'll talk about that tomorrow. We'll get into that.
Yeah, let's hold off on that.
All right, so today's segment is a I'm going to give you five World War II movie trivia questions.
Oh boy.
So we will spin the wheel and see what random questions Jim gets. And the good thing is, Jim, that this is very Great Escape and Stalag 7, Great Escape, Dirty Dozen, Saving Private Ryan, Prisoner of River Kwai, heavy. So maybe you'll get a question from one of those. You never know. Yep.
It can happen.
Actually, here's your first question, and it actually is. So there you go. Okay, what
Okay.
famous actor is in both The Great Escape and Bridge on the River Kwai?
William Holden?
He's not in The Great Escape.
No, wait. No, he's not in The Great Escape. Hang on.
Nope.
Gordon Jackson? Attenborough?
No,
Attenborough's
he's
in both
not.
of them, isn't he? Oh my gosh, hang on. I'm trying to think of the, I can think greatest. I'm going down the list of everybody in Great Escape. Not James Garner, not Steve McQueen, not
Madness, madness.
I'm looking at, oh, wait, Alec Guinness is not in the Great Escape, is
No,
no.
he doesn't say madness.
I'm
It's
drawing a
said
I've
about Nicholson, but it's not
Wait,
not
I'm
Nicholson.
going through my, oh shoot, I have to think about this. the short guy. Oh
No,
crap, let me
it's
think.
not it's
No,
not
not
Ives.
Ives. It's not Coburn. It's not Donald Pleasance. Donald Pleasance, both of them?
Nope.
No. I'm at a loss. I'm trying to think of everybody in. I'm thinking. Steve McQueen, not James Garner, not Richard Attenborough, Donald Pleasance, Gordon Jackson is not in Bridge on the River Kwai. I don't know. I can't
Okay,
think of
it's
who it is.
James Donald, who plays the SBO in The Great Escape, the senior British officer.
Okay. Yes, I know who you mean. I know who you mean. I didn't know that was his name.
Okay, and it was Ramsey in
Yeah.
that, and he played Clipton, the doctor, in Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Bridge on the River Kwai, he's pretty much the only one who lives.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah, I know the yeah, the senior British senior officer was that guy. I can't. Yeah. Sorry.
That's
Okay.
okay. That's okay. All right, let's spin the wheel for your next question. Round and round and round the wheel goes. Okay, this is a
Hang
movie
on,
you would recognize.
you're
In the movie 12 O'Clock High, who is the commander of the pilots?
Wait,
Who's the
Pack? You mean,
actor who plays him?
are you talking about Gregory Peck?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
There you go. Yes, it is Gregory.
Was easy enough.
Well, you get easy ones too.
Yeah.
Okay, in the 1970 film Tora Tara Tara, okay, what actor who starred in the movie was also serving in Pearl Harbor during the actual attack in 1941?
Was it James Whitmore?
Nope.
It wasn't Toshiro Mifune.
No.
Let me think. There's so many people in that film. It wasn't
He's an actor who won two Oscars in during his career.
wow. Was it E.G. Marshall?
No, E.G. Marshall never won an Oscar.
Okay. Trying to think of other famous people. Joseph Cotton couldn't have been at Pearl Harbor because he was busy making Citizen Kane. Jason Robards?
Exactly. So, Jason
Okay.
Robards, yes.
That's good because I just ran out of American actors I could think of.
There we go. Yes, the answer is Jason
Oh, and the
Robards.
guy that, wait, I'm trying to think of the other, Richard Dean Anderson's dad, Oscar Goldman from $6 Million Man is the only other American I can think of. Oh wait, no, Martin Balsam's in the movie. Martin Balsam's in the movie too. He's the one that's looking out the window. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you're not talking about wait, who's thinking of? Not Jack Klugman, no.
No. Richard Anderson.
Oh,
He
the
was
real Richard. Oh, okay, Richard Anderson.
Richard
Richard Anderson
Anderson. Yeah,
from
there. Yeah.
$6 Million Man, isn't it?
$6 Million Man. Yeah, Oscar Goldman. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I when you said Oscar, I thought you
Yeah,
said
Oscar
Oscar
Gold. No,
Madison.
no. That's Oscar Madison.
I know. That's
Yeah.
what I heard you say. So,
Yeah.
okay.
Yeah. No, I'm just. I don't know how you sort people out in movies, but I always think of what scene is in what, and I think of like Martin Balsam crying, looking at stuff, and Jason Robards, and James Whitmore was Admiral Halsey. So I think
Right.
about, it's like, okay, I can, but. Yeah, just I can't. Who's the guy with There's Your Confirmation? He said we can't do anything without confirmation. I can't think of his name. Anyway, that's
All right. Let's move on
it's
to the next
let's leave
question.
that alone. Yes.
All right, let's spin the wheel for your first question. Okay. In the movie The Devil's Brigade, what famous game show host from the 70s and 80s plays Private Hugh McDonald?
Was it Peter Marshall?
Nope. Famous game show host.
Wasn't Art Fleming. Wasn't
Top six answers
oh,
on the board.
I know this. No, you're th I'm sitting here thinking game show host. Hang on. I know I can see wait, it's Hogan's Heroes. Richard Dawson.
Very good,
Okay.
yes.
I'm thinking Peter Marshall, Hugh Downs? No, it's yeah. Richard Dawson. I keep forgetting Family Feud's a game show. Richard Dawson. That's right.
It's
Richard
what
Dawson was doing everything at the time.
that's not that's what would you classify it if it's not a game show?
No, it is a game show. It's mostly Richard Dawson's excuse to kiss people on TV.
No, just to kiss women,
Yeah, just
not to
kiss
kiss
women.
people.
Yeah.
I don't recall if he ever kissed a man. I think he
100
just
people
kissed a woman.
surveyed.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. There we go.
All right. And now we will spin the wheel for your final question.
Thank goodness.
Are you suffering that much, Jim? Is
I
that what
got
you're saying?
what did I get? 2 out of 4 so far? I think or one out, yeah,
No.
eventually. I get them eventually.
You get them eventually. You got 3 out of 4.
Wow, okay.
Okay. Have you ever seen the movie A Walk in the Sun?
No.
Okay, so I hope you'll be able to get this one if that's the case. we'll have to figure that out. So, what famous actor, okay, who lived to the age of 106, and starred in both Saint Elsewhere and Dead Poets Society? Portrays the character of okay, portrays the character of Archibald, Private Archibald in the movie A Walk in the Sun.
So it's got to be. I don't know who the. I'm trying to think of people that live to be 105 would be either
106.
Charles 100, how much? 106.
106.
Norman Lloyd,
Very good.
because it's either him or Charles Rosen.
There you go.
So
It was Norman Lloyd, yes.
Norman Lloyd, yeah, he's just only famous for being Lloyd. And if it was a woman, it would have been Olivia de Havilland. But that's. Okay, I never saw the movie, but I can name old actors.
There you go. All right. Perfect. Nicely done. See, so you got 4 out of 5. So
Okay.
I don't know what you're
That's
complaining
a good solid B. Yeah.
about. Nicely done, Jim. There are other guests that have done a lot worse. You're in good company.
I gotta watch more movies. I know how many movies you watch. I've gotta watch more movies. That's my problem. I've watched enough movies a minute at a time. So I just gotta
Well,
sit down and watch a movie
it helps you to
front
get
to
a beat.
end.
So there you go.
Yeah.
All right, and now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. And again, it's possible that you're going to get something that we've talked about.
Okay.
So let's spin the wheel and see what's left on of the.
Oh dear.
It's actually funny. You did get one of the ones that we've just talked about. So let's see if you can figure out which one it is. Okay, this is a movie that came out in 1968, and it stars William Holden, Cliff Robertson, and it's about a lieutenant colonel who is tasked with forming an elite commando style unit in, to move forward and destroy the Germans.
Okay, well, I would have said the Dirty Dozen, but I don't think Cliff Robertson's in that.
Neither is William Holden, so that's fine.
That's right. Yeah. So, hang on, Dirty Dozen, Kelly's Heroes,
It's
an elite.
one of the movies we just talked about in your trivia question.
Oh, criminy. I'm sorry. I'm really. Let's see. We just talked about it in the trivia. We talked about Bridge on the River Kwai, which was back in 1953.
57.
So, yeah. And then after that, Stalag 17 is before that. But this, and this got nothing to do with a late group. 68. Yeah, see, 68, I keep thinking of Kelly's Heroes, but that's 1970.
That's right.
And it wasn't the one that you had suggested that I should watch because I haven't watched it. This is gonna kill me. 1968 World War II movie. I do not know. I'm gonna have to. I know you said it was in one of the previous ones, but all the ones that I'm thinking of that you had mentioned were like 50s and 40s.
You want me to tell you the five movies that we talked about in the trivia? Okay.
Okay.
So we had 12 O'Clock High, A Walk in the Sun, Devil's Brigade, Tora Tora Tora, and The Great Escape, Bridge on the River Kwai.
A Walk in the Sun was 1940 something. So, Devil's, I guess it's Devil's Brigade. It must be
It
Devil's Brigade.
is the Devil's
Okay.
Brigade.
Okay, I have to watch that movie. I'm sorry. I just
Well, you know that you're not going to get any more trivia questions about it, so you don't have to worry.
Okay. I can stand easy now. Okay.
That's right. Okay, so Jim, would you like to tell everyone once again where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Yes, we are deep. We're also in the middle of World War II, except we're fighting Hydra over at the Captain America minute, where we're talking about the Joe Johnson's big MCU movie, Captain America: The First Avenger, made in 2011. So it's a 21st century film, and we are talking way too much about it. But you can join us. You can find us at capminute.com or wherever your favorite podcasts, like the one you're listening to right now, are distributed. So go look for a Captain America Minute podcast, and you can listen to me and Hal Bryan and Brian Feese talk about way too much stuff about Captain America.
No, I wouldn't. I disagree with that. You don't talk about way too many things. You guys talk about some great things.
Well, we try our best,
I enjoy
and
it.
it's always and we always get great cheerleading from you, Rob. Thank you very much for giving feedback to our show. We always appreciate feedback, positive, negative, although yours is just generally positive, so I'm always happy about that, and always happy to
I
share it with
tried giving you negative, and it didn't work. Okay.
It's good. Well, we're just going to keep going, and we've only got about 40 more episodes. So tune in soon when you want to still hear it live or nearly live.
Right. Okay. Perfect. All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Ramen. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movieramen.com. And if you want to send me an email, send it to movieramen@moverab.net. So, until tomorrow, Kurahi!
Kurahi!